Over my winter break, I took a train back and forth to Miami. This is about 27 hours each way. And gave me a chance to listen to recordings of a year's worth of lectures that Herbert Dreyfuss gave at Berkeley on Heidegger. The whole thing is available now on YouTube. And don't worry, this doesn't mean I'm about to inflict a Heidegger seminar on you. It's a discussion group. But I wanted to draw a few necessarily superficial comparisons between Heidegger's concerns and some of what goes on in Zen, to try to look at some of what we're doing from a slightly different angle. See, I think you see in Heidegger someone preoccupied with some of the same things that preoccupy us in Zen, starting with basic ideas of non-separation and emptiness, although he calls these, by very different names and uses a very esoteric language, an abstract language to describe them. But one of the ways to begin to think about the language he uses is to compare it to the language of koans, in that where he's starting is saying that the reality of the world is non-separate, but our language, our ordinary language, is so totally, thoroughly imbued with notions of separation, of self and object, self and the world, that to use ordinary language is already to become complicit in a philosophical mistake. So he's trying to develop a way of talking that bypasses the ordinary assumptions that we make. So he's trying to develop a language of his own to talk about non-separation or non-dualism. And he uses a language that emphasizes that everything that we do is embedded, or we are embedded, in a whole background of unacknowledged and never made explicit background assumptions and coping mechanisms. And he calls this background familiarity and coping, and those are some of his words. What he's getting at is that, just as we would say a fish doesn't explore the ocean and find out what water is, so we are in our world, intimate, living in the midst of it, not separate from it and trying to explore it. We would say that because of the nature of oceans and the nature of water, you can get a fish, right? You can't, there's no fish to start with and then it tries to learn what water is, right? It's only because there's water in the first place that fish arise. So he would say that our position is sort of as a creature embedded in this world that has, unlike the fish, come to be aware of and explore and question its own medium, its waterness, the water in which it lives. He calls that being there, Dasein, a kind of existence that's become aware of its own existence, its own embeddedness. The thing about our everyday embeddedness or coping, however, is that it can, in part, it conceals the other basic truth of the world, which is emptiness, or he would say something like groundlessness. We have and take for granted a whole set of practices, what Wittgenstein would call a form of life, that enable us to move around in the world. But in fact, all of these are, in a sense, purely of our social creation and invention. Our, particularly our cultural norms and morality and everything else that regulates our daily life. All the stuff about stopping at red lights and things like that, we take for granted, do automatically, but we never really consider what they're based on. And that level of conventional existence, Heidegger sort of refers to it as what one does. And the one that what one does there is called Das Man, the one. So it's not oneness, you know, like in Buddhism, but it's sort of like what every man takes for granted and does automatically. And his concern is whether we're able to ever stop and see behind the veil of conventionality, ordinary experience. And he says that what we think of normally as guilt or conscience keeps the veil in place. Ordinary guilt sort of tells us that this morality has a real basis. It obscures the fact that it's all convention. Similarly, he makes a distinction between understanding and explaining, where understanding is the kind of wordless embodied activity that arises out of non-separation. So he would say, we understand that when we walk across the floor, it's going to hold us up. We understand that when I pick up the striker to hit the gong, I'm going to be able to lift it. I understand that if I drop it, it's going to fall. That if I try to walk through the door, I'll fit. See, all of these things are implicit background assumptions that are never spelled out. We never try to make a list of them. Or follow rules in order to understand them. And we don't have to do any of those things because they're all sort of the water to our fish, right? That's our immersion in the world, is to have this kind of completely unconscious background familiarity. And he calls that understanding. And he contrasts that with explanation. And he says explanation is when you start trying to figure out why the floor holds you up, or weigh the striker to see if it's going to be light enough to pick up or not, or try to tell somebody all the rules of the Zendo. Right? Explanation means entering the world of separate objects and creating rules that govern their existence. He sort of would say that's impossible to do, to cover all the background situations that we handle naturally all the time. But whenever we enter into that explainer's mind, we're entering the world of separation. And I think you see that that's what happens in a lot of koans, where there's questions like, the world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your robe at the sound of the gong? It's sort of a trick question that invites you to step into the world of separate explanation, right? Or if a koan asks you, how do you stop the sound of a temple bell in Kyoto? It's framing a question in the world of separation and distance, and asking for explanation, whereas what the koan wants you to do is show understanding. Okay? Now, for Heidegger, our authenticity only emerges when something happens that allows us to see the groundlessness of our conventional lives and practice, to in some sense see the emptiness underlying the relative. And that really is what he refers to as death, which is not the end of life, but the collapse of a conventional worldview into sort of this abyss of groundlessness. And the challenge is to be able to see the world non-separate, empty, and still function within it. It's an interesting sideline about Dreyfus, the Heidegger scholar, that he was teaching at MIT in the 50s and early 60s when, across the hall from the philosophy department, all these people were working on the first artificial intelligence programs for computers. And so he was lecturing about the difference between explanation and understanding, and sort of saying that what we understand is these endless things, like the floor is going to hold you up when you walk across it, right? And he said, think of what it would be like if, when you give somebody beginner's instruction in a Zendo, you tell them that now when you come in, you have to be able to walk through the door. And then when you walk on the floor, that's going to hold you up. Don't worry, you can do that. And then the cushion, that's going to hold your weight, and you sit down on that. And the 10,000 completely unobserved and unarticulated assumptions about how the world works. And he said, if you try to give explanations of all that, the list would be literally endless. And so he walked across the hall to the AI guys and he said, by the way, what you're trying to do is create an explanation for the background and codify it in rules. and it's not going to work. You're never going to be able to do it. And it really pissed them off. But he turned out to be right. And he wrote a book called What Computers Can't Do, and sort of articulated this problem. And 20 years later, he wrote another book called What Computers Still Can't Do. And it's very interesting the way it all emerged out of this Heideggerian sense of the real infinity of the background, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the particular thing that struck me, though, hearing some of this, was the way in which our necessary, ordinary ways of thinking obscure a whole other dimension of existence. And that even though we can't do without this ordinary way of looking at things, something has to happen to shake that up if we're ever going to see this other dimension. And I thought of it in terms of the way I go on about no gain in this practice. Because we are immersed in a way of thinking that it's instrumental and talks about means to ends and benefits. And so the language of the benefit of meditation is inescapable. Everybody's doing studies about the benefits of meditation. And that's like this ordinary way of talking about things in terms of separations and objects and selves and objects and conventional ways of doing things. We can't do without that language. We can't do without the language of means to end thinking. And yet, to me, the whole point of our practice is to show that meditation does something completely different, opens up a completely different dimension than the dimension of means to ends and benefits. And the more that we explore the benefits of meditation, the more we completely miss the idea that there's something completely different going on, or could go on. See, that other level is all about things being whole and complete, like water for the fish, just as they are. That it's about our trying to be immersed in our experience, regardless of its content, where nothing has to be fixed or achieved or uncovered. And that is nothing like the way we ordinarily think about things. See, Heidegger talks about the idea that unless something happens that really disrupts your ordinary way of thinking, something that plunges you into anxiety about the groundlessness of what's going on, you never get to see this other dimension of existence. And part of the way I think about Zen practice is that in a certain way, unless it really fails, right? Unless your whole project of benefit fails you, you don't usually get much chance to see that there's a whole other way of thinking about it. right? We need that kind of anxiety of the crash and burn of our curative fantasy in order for there to be any room for anything else to happen. So really, what you all have to wish for in your practice is that it really fails you, right? That whole inevitable curative fantasy mode of practicing, in some way or another, you realize it ain't going to work, because it's only then that we might see that it doesn't have to.